Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 91. Is this the fast that I have chosen? Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And we're here today in our continuing series looking at Reform Judaism, the idea and the movement. And we're joined by Jonah Pesner. He is the director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism and also the senior vice president of the Union for Reform Judaism. Rabbi Jonah Pesner has been named by Newsweek magazine as one of the most influential rabbis in America. The work of the Religious Action Center is something that we'll get into as we go on with this episode, but it clearly is one of the more important manifestations of the Reform movement's commitment to the prophetic vision of Judaism as a force for social justice, which has been part of the Reform movement from the beginning. And we're very excited to speak with Jonah Pesner, who is leading those efforts through his position at the Religious Action Center, also known as the RAC. Prior to taking on this position in 2011, Jonah Pesner was the rabbi, a congregational rabbi at Temple Israel in Boston and Temple Israel in Westport, Connecticut. No relation, but we're really excited to welcome him today and to talk about Reform Judaism and its commitment to social justice and political action. Jonah Pesner, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's a thrill to have you.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here. Thanks, Lex.
Well, so I think we wanted to get started just with some basics, because as far as I know, the other organized movements of Judaism don't have something analogous to a Religious Action Center in Washington, D.C. And it would be great if you could just tell us a little bit about what the Religious Action Center is and how did it come to be and what's it all about in terms of the connection to the parts of Reform Judaism that I think we're more familiar with, like synagogues.
Whenever I tell this story, Dan, people are just kind of moved and blown away by the history of our role in the civil rights movement and in social justice. So the RAC, as we affectionately call the Religious Action Center, RAC, is the hub of Jewish social justice and civil rights advocacy located here in Washington. But our evolution, though we started in Washington, we now have leaders and staff across North America engaging our nearly 2 million folk who call themselves Reform Jews, and then many more who are not, you know, affiliated with us formally, but we engage them on a local level, on a state level, and on a federal level to take action to make the world better and to pursue social justice and really address the systemic underlying root causes of inequality, racism, poverty, and the like. But here's our origin story. So there was an amazing Jewish philanthropist named Kivi Kaplan, and he was a Jew from Boston. He was a trustee of the what was then called the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, what is now the URJ, the Union for Reform Judaism. He was a member of Temple Israel in Boston, where I happened to serve as a rabbi sometime later, which is kind of beshert and cool. But when he was a young man, he took his new bride, Emily, to their honeymoon in Florida. And he decided to take Emily to a country club. And the taxi arrived to take them to this country club in Florida. And there was a sign at the door, no Jews, no dogs. And Kivi turned to the black taxi driver who had delivered them to this place, incredulous, and asked this African-American, you know, was this common? He had never seen anything like it. And the black taxi driver looked at Kivi and said, they don't even bother with us. And Kivi had a realization that many of us have come to understand, which is, you know, no Jews, no dogs, they don't even bother with us. We are all in this together, you know, all of us folk, minorities, black, brown, white, Latino, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, we are all in this together. And so he did a couple things. One is he became the president of the NAACP. And he was actually the last white Jewish president of the NAACP when he finished his term in the 70s. And in part of his leadership of the Reform movement, he bought the building that I am sitting in, 2027 Massachusetts Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C., a beautiful embassy-like building right here in the center and the heart of the nation's capital, and he donated it to the Reform Jewish movement. But he challenged us and he said, the condition by which you take this gift is that you need to become the hub of civil rights activity, the center of Jewish social justice, and specifically to host the various leadership entities of civil rights in America. And that's why our founding director, Rabbi Dick Hirsch, called his good friend, a young dynamic pastor named Martin, and said, Martin, you now have an office to use in Washington. So Dr. King, whenever he would come to town, he would use our offices. Rabbi Hirsch reached out to the Leadership Conference of Civil Rights, which was kind of the ad hoc coordinating body, and invited the Leadership Conference to have their offices here in our Religious Action Center, which is why it is, Dan, that a piece of American Jewish history that not many people know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 were drafted in part in our conference room right here in Washington, D.C. So it was a Reform Jewish institution that housed not only the Leadership Conference, but gave rise to some of the most important civil rights legislation in American history.
Could you tell us about how that has all evolved? What does the RAC do today?
Sure. One thing we don't do is hang around in the castle of nostalgia. The RAC has grown enormously over that period of time, the nearly 60 years of our history. When Rabbi Hirsch started, it was just him and a secretary. And Rabbi David Saperstein became the director sometime later, my predecessor, now Ambassador Rabbi David Saperstein. David led this institution for 40 years, which is a great biblical number. And over that time, not only did the RAC grow and thrive, he created the Eisendrath Legislative Assistant Program that brings around five or six young adults, new college graduates to the RAC. We work on 72 issues, and so these idealistic young people represent us in coalitions, a variety of reproductive choice, LGBT equality, Islamophobia, anti-Muslim bigotry, and we have staff working on, you know, a variety of legislative and policy issues and advocacy issues. So over the 40 years, Rabbi Saperstein really worked with the URJ and the Central Conference of American Rabbis to form leadership teams, social action committees in synagogues across North America to make sure that we had what we call RACtivists, activists who are based in their synagogues, working on our issues, sending in action alerts, calling their members of Congress, visiting us here in Washington. One of the other innovations that Rabbi Saperstein created, and this is another story that goes in the, like, you can't make this up. Back in the early 80s, David had this idea that we should not only advocate here on Capitol Hill, but we should bring teenagers to Washington from our synagogues, train them, teach them Jewish texts on social justice, look at biblical, prophetic, and rabbinic literature, and then go down to Capitol Hill, go meet with members of the administration, go advocate in members of Congress's offices and Senate offices. And he reached out to a couple of rabbinical students in New York in the early 80s and asked them if they wanted to do this. They turned to their youth group president at the time. That was me. I was in 10th grade. I was 16 years old. And these charismatic young rabbis, Marla Feldman and Barney Brickner, who asked me, did I want to bring the youth group to Washington? I said, well, you know, will there be girls there? And because, you know, it was this great trip to DC, we brought like 8 or 10 teenagers and had the first ever, what we now call the Litaken seminar, meaning to repair the world seminar for Jewish social justice. We met right in that same conference room where the Voting Rights Act was written. It was just David Saperstein and 10 teenagers. And it changed my life because I discovered, even as a 16-year-old, the power of Jewish tradition to speak truth to power and the power of our community to go amplify our values in the public square and to hold our elected officials accountable to our enduring beliefs. Since that first Litaken seminar back in 84, we've brought more than 60,000 teenagers to Washington. So we bring thousands of teenagers here. We have a summer residency program for college students. We bring more than 50 college students here every summer. We have the legislative assistant program that brings young adults here. So we also are a major Jewish engagement strategy to not only inspire the next generation to take Judaism seriously, but to animate their Judaism into the public square.
I think anybody who's listening and fretting about those Jewish organizational succession problems should learn something from David Saperstein as to how to identify your successor at a very young age and start grooming them, right? Yeah, that's good. So what does the rack do today?
The strength of the rack always was our power and our presence here in Washington. But we were discovering more and more that synagogues, learning from their Christian neighbors, actually, could become agents of change on the local level. We were, a couple of rabbis, including me, were learning from organizations like the Industrial Areas Foundation, which was created by Saul Alinsky, and the PICO Network. Collections of churches that had come together to build local power, to create networks of relationships within their churches, but then also across lines of difference, neighborhood, faith, race, and then collectively act with power on local mayors, city councils, get more funding for public schools, get more affordable housing built, create more healthcare access. And a group of us pioneered bringing Jewish synagogues into this kind of work. And we learned that this was a way that we could really not only make change on a local level, but we could really engage not just the racktivists, the two or three kind of prophetic types who want to speak truth to power and come to Washington, but hundreds and hundreds of members of congregations who could show up to actions with mayors and meetings with city council people, who could engage in sacred conversations within their congregations to identify what are the issues that we really care about, what keeps us up at night, to study in small groups Jewish text and tradition to kind of root the various political issues that they were working on deeply in our tradition, and then to create really robust relationships across lines of difference to reach out to the Muslim community, African-American Christians, Latino Catholic parishes, white evangelicals, and collectively ask, like, how could we work with governors? How could we work with state legislatures and put pressure on our elected officials to make change? That enabled us over the last 10 years to really create a grassroots army across our movement so that we have synagogues now working in California and Ohio and Texas and New York that are our partners here in Washington, that are putting pressure on members of Congress, on senators, but are doing much more deep and sustainable work with their local mayors, their local police chiefs, their local school boards, to really move an agenda that is an agenda around our enduring Jewish values, refracted through the lens of interfaith dialogue, to bring in Christian voices and Muslim voices, and to really affect change at a local level. And we've seen, you know, incredible victories, schools getting built, healthcare access being expanded, campaigns for LGBT equality, all motivated by the organized faith community acting together in partnership.
My favorite part of the Religious Action Center, or one of my favorite parts, is what I read as sort of an implication, a strong and radical implication by its name, the Religious Action Center. I was first exposed to the RAC when I was in DC for a summer interning for a different, or I was interning for Hillel, and a bunch of friends of mine were doing the summer program that you talked about, Mahon Kaplan. And because of its size, and it sort of became like the hub of Jewish interns that summer in DC. And I remember asking them early in the summer, like, okay, so you're at this thing called the Religious Action Center, but it seems like you're all doing like political work. Like, why is it called the Religious Action Center and not the Political Action Center? And I forget exactly where the conversation went. I'm sure it was a good one. But what I eventually came to realize is that there seems to be a statement that, oh, the religious action is political action. And there's actually a really deep and historic connection Jewishly between those two concepts. And I'd love to hear from you, because I mean, maybe some pushback we've certainly gotten in comment threads on our show is that, oh, like, your religion isn't really Judaism. It's just, you know, social justice. It's just liberalism, whatever it might be. And I'd love to hear, like, what are sort of the animating principles that underlie this idea that the Religious Action Center is actually something that does a great deal of important political and organizing work?
Maybe, Lex, I could come at the answer through my own political story as a young person and then circle back to it. Because I think for all of us, we're asking the same question that you were asking. So I grew up in New York City, very active in a Reform Jewish synagogue. I first came at religious life because of community. My dad was the temple president. We went, you know, almost every Friday night. We had Shabbat dinner every Friday night. The rabbi of our congregation used to famously say, with filling me with pride, the first Shabbat dinner he ever ate in this community was at the Pesner family house. Like, I thought it was normal and typical that every Reformed Jewish home, you know, observe Shabbat in that way. And I loved the temple. It was like, you know, from the Purim carnival to religious school, my youth group. It was the place where I found meaning and purpose. It wasn't as much about theology in the beginning or text as it was just about the people. My father died suddenly when I was in high school, and my mother became a single working mother. We lived in affordable housing, and I felt vulnerable for the first time in my life as a 10th grader. Actually, it was just a few months before I met Rabbi Saperstein here in Washington, again, in the you can't make this stuff up category. The temple saved my spiritual life, right? Like being part of the youth group and being part of the community, being mentored by young rabbis who really took me under their wing. And it was in that community that I learned the texts and the traditions that called me to do justice in the world. But it got kind of even more interesting because I went to a public school, the best public school that I could get into. We couldn't afford private school at that point. I went to a great place called the Bronx High School of Science. Great school, really bad neighborhood. This is from the early 1982 to 1986. Every morning I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and get on the number 4 train. For those people that are listening that don't know New York City, that's at the kind of lower tip of Manhattan at Union Square, and ride through Midtown to the Upper East Side, where at 86th Street, all the white people would get off the train. I was the only white kid on the train, through Harlem, into the South Bronx. And at 161st Street Yankee Stadium, the train would go up above ground, become an elevated train. And I would witness from the windows of that subway train, the most devastated, burnt out shell of a neighborhood with just acres and acres of abandoned, burnt out, horrendous, you know, buildings with no windows and rubble and fires burning, enormous poverty, homelessness was spreading like a plague. And I would look into the neighborhood from the windows of that train, feeling both afraid for my own safety and then ashamed of the racism and the fear, and wonder to myself, who could live in that neighborhood? And a kid would get on the train and be sitting next to me in math class. And so there was this grinding disconnect for me, Lex, between the social justice message of my rabbis and the prophetic books of like Isaiah and Hosea and Micah that I was reading at Sunday school and what I was witnessing in the South Bronx every day on my way to school. And so I was determined to become a rabbi who would not just engage the next generation and be a Jewish continuity rabbi. I was going to be a street fighter rabbi who's going to figure out to make my synagogue just a couple of miles away from that devastation relevant to the folks in that neighborhood. And living in the two worlds that I lived in, of the mostly upper middle class, mostly white Jewish community, but having a mom who was a single working mother and was nervous about whether we were going to actually be able to stay in our community or not, I became keenly aware of how life is inherently political. The decisions that get made about how that public school I went to got funded, how the affordable housing that we lived in got constructed, and who was going to save that neighborhood. Now, here's the coda to the story. Some years later, when I got involved in the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization, an affiliate of the Industrial Heirs Foundation, when I was a rabbi at Temple Israel in Boston, and early on trying to figure out how to make real my vision, a Lutheran minister from Roxbury, Mass, told me that he needed to stretch my imagination. He had been pastoring back in the South Bronx in the 90s. And he brought me and a bunch of leaders from the Jewish community from Boston to go do a site visit to the South Bronx. And we bore witness to what had happened, the transformation of the South Bronx. South Bronx churches, a collection of mostly Christian communities, but in allyship with a synagogue, rebuilt the South Bronx. They put pressure on Ed Koch to donate the land. They worked with Wall Street to give them favorable mortgages. And they redeemed the South Bronx, which when I witnessed it, acres and acres of owner-occupied affordable housing, like freshly painted, kids playing safely in the street, people sitting on stoops, freshly planted gardens. And I turned to Reverend Heinemeier and I said, Rev, you are the kind of rabbi that I need to be. He taught me that his faith tradition was inherently political, because if you were in the neighborhoods of the South Bronx and a member of that church, not to be political would be to abdicate the gospel, and for me as a Jew, to advocate the injunction, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice, we shall pursue.
So I think it's clear to our listeners that I'm not much of a synagogue attender. And when I hear what you're describing, I think to myself, gee, I wish that there was like a rack nearby. You know, like, why do I have to Why is this sort of have to be sort of wrapped up in a network of synagogues whose sort of primary product, so to speak, is one that I and I think a lot of others like me are not particularly interested in, and yet there's this other product, so to, you know, secondary isn't quite the word, but it doesn't feel, it's not presented as the main thing that this organization does, that I think would be much more compelling to many of us Jews who I think really do in some fundamental way, whether we can articulate it or not, understand what I think you're saying, that understand that social activism is a manifestation of our religious or heritage, if you don't want to call it religious, you know, our tradition.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the question. And, you know, Dan, as you could hear from my own story, I'm a synagogue Jew because of my lived experience. And I'm, you know, but I have friends, and I know, you know, plenty of my best friends aren't synagogue Jews, or who are Jewish anyway. So two things are true at the same time, right? One is we are much more powerful when our networks are stronger. Alinsky talked about like organized people and organized money having power. It's a lot easier to organize the Jewish community through existing networks, right? The fact that I have nearly 900 congregations representing 2 million souls led by 2,000 rabbis, that gives me a lot of leverage. And when I actually organize those congregations and mobilize them and have heft with them, then we can get a lot done. You know, we have senators and members of Congress who feel the pressure. You know, Senator Rob Portman in Ohio, during the fight about repealing and replacing Obamacare, he had 32 rabbis bring their congregants to his office early and often, demanding that he do the right thing. Now, he didn't. He voted the wrong way, even though members of his own congregations, if that had passed, would lose healthcare access. But that was new for us. We had never mobilized on a statewide level with so much heft and so much power. If we continue to do that, we're really going to be able to have an impact. That said, as many people act with and through our synagogues, there are Jews who are outside of our synagogues, and that would be another network. You know, reformjudaism.org has something like 10 million unique users. There's not 10 million Reform Jews. So we are beginning to figure out ways that our networks will actually engage people. One of the questions we have is like, could reformjudaism.org, which gets lots of individuals, but then creates a virtual network, could that network be another way that we're both leveraging a base to have more political power and be meaningful in the lives of Jews who discover meaning and purpose? By the way, many of those 10 million unique users are not even Jewish. So we're actually opening Judaism up to a whole cohort of people. By the way, one other thing I want to say is I'm really passionate about this. I think if we succeed and we really get into the synagogues and empower them to be agents of change rooted in text and tradition, more members will join because the institutions will look like their values and what they want the synagogue to be in the public square.
Yeah, I think that the thing that I'm trying to sort of work through, and I think you're getting there too, is what I call the bundling problem. You know, that the idea that, you know, sort of analogous to the music industry, that I really wanted to get this one song, but if the only way to buy that one song was that I had to buy this whole album that cost 10 times as much as the song, then I'm probably not going to buy that song, right? And I'll find another way to enjoy that 3 minutes that I was trying to enjoy through that song. I'll find a different way to do it. And you know, for me, it's thinking about, is there a way to, again, sort of present social justice work, political activism, et cetera, as a primary manifestation of Judaism, as a primary way to practice Judaism, I should say, so that if I come to do that through the synagogue, there's not an expectation that I'm doing anything wrong by not coming to services. You know, that's not the ideal, that, oh, we hope that some of these people will also start coming to synagogue services. It's more that, no, we offer 3, 4, 5 different routes to be a good Jew, right? And I've said to my rabbi, you know, for example, look, if there was a weekly protest in front of Trump Tower on Shabbat morning, I would be there every week. Now, you know, you want to throw in a few prayers, fine, you know, but you know, that I'm there for the activism, you know, and I'm just trying to get at, you know, are we too sort of locked in to a set of ways of organizing our religious practice that are actually, that work really well for some people, but that for other people will never work well, and if we present them as the main way that we do it, then we're sort of, I feel like giving up a possibility of engaging, you know, another 1.5-2 million people, right, who would happily join a Jewish institution that was profoundly devoted to social justice and activism and resistance and whatever we want to call it, but that just don't consider themselves religious because of how they understand religious to involve worship.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. And, you know, some of our congregations are actually doing some of what I think you described. And because they know that it's what the moment calls for and what many of their folks are looking for. You know, the question you asked, though, you know, you could go be part of a protest every week. You don't need the synagogue or Judaism to do that. So the fact that we're having this conversation at all tells me there is more to the story, right? Now, right. I'm at one end of the spectrum, right? I get a thing out of study, right? I've got this thing with the text and I love to pray and I love to sing. Though I'm not at shul every Friday night, much as my rabbi, Rabbi Roos, might say, hey, you know, I haven't seen you lately, right? So I think at the end of the day, the thing that all that the thread, because we are the Reform Jewish movement, we have God, we have Torah, we have Israel, we have activism as a function of that and organizing for justice. There is something that we believe about a community in which all of that is happening and members are connected, even though they don't do each thing all the time. It's all part of the glue in the fabric that is the thing. And at the end of the day, what keeps people in it are the relationships. It's about the relationships, the relationships, the relationships. When I described that picture at the beginning about, you know, my father dying suddenly and the rabbi described how we were the first family and then Rabbi Saperstein called his two disciples who asked me, right? It was all about people in relationship with one another. I think every kind of spin-off or entity that we've created has modeled excellent relationship building. Right, people often say, well, the RAC and the URJ camps are two of our best things. And you might think, well, what does a camp have to do with the RAC? The commonality is it's a network of relationships where people find meaning and purpose by doing something together. And I think that's where our congregations at the end of the day at their best are creating that so that Dan says, well, I'm not a synagogue Jew, but I am a Beth Elohim guy because at Beth Elohim, I'm finding an outlet for my activism and other people who breathe life into that and give me a place to have meaning and purpose.
You know, when you have an entity like the Religious Action Center that kind of puts a stake in the ground very firmly, that supports a lot of policies that are generally deemed to be progressive in America, what does that mean for members who don't subscribe to those principles? Does that mean that Reform Judaism really stands for a political worldview that's different from theirs or not?
There are plenty of right-thinking conservative Jews with a small c and progressive Jews, meaning politically. There are people who ideologically call themselves Republicans or call themselves Democrats. They all get a say. And then at some point, if not a consensus, at least a majority opinion emerges. Although because we go through so much process, we really reflect the values and the opinions of many, many, many members. Even then, we work very hard to make sure that the Devar Acher, the alternative opinion, the minority opinion, gets published and amplified. So in the Talmud, as you may know, the minority opinion always gets published, right? It's like we know what Hillel said because Hillel was often the majority, but we also know what Shammai said because the rabbis also lift up the voice of Rabbi Shammai. So we do the same thing. We will often create a forum online for debate and discussion. We'll have many sessions at the biennial where the alternative view gets expressed. And then it just, when the rubber hits the road, it's not helpful if I go into a member of Congress and say, you know, I'm here to advocate for, you know, the Voting Rights Restoration Act, except, you know, some number of thousands of Reform Jews who dissent. So that's the point at which we've made a collective decision, we've honored the minority, and then we move forward. And the last thing I'll say about this, I keep coming back to Jewish text and tradition. Again, what differentiates us is the deep process of Jewish learning that we go through to have our positions flow from the voice of antiquity and the voice of our values, and then be amplified using that authentic language. So people know we're speaking for Judaism. We're not speaking for one political party or the other.
I wanted to revisit a thread that came up in terms of this question of, you know, if we're doing this justice work in congregations, in whatever organizations, like hopefully that will be assigned to people out there that are looking for it, that they will, you know, be more likely to join them. And I feel like often there's a challenge or There's an issue to confront on that line of questioning, because what I worry about, and I don't think either of you are doing this, but I think some people occasionally do, is when we turn justice, when we turn human rights, when we turn all of the issues that you've brought up into means towards engaging the Jews, means towards involving people in Jewish practice, I think we do something really dangerous, because what that says is, if a congregation or if anybody does some sort of justice initiative that's really important, if they're fighting Islamophobia in their community, if they're, I mean, you talked about sanctuary cities, if you're fighting transphobia, if you're, you know, working on economic justice, like if you do that and then people don't join, then it's like, oh, I guess that didn't work. Let's do the next not social justice thing. It instrumentalizes something that I think everybody should look at as not a means, but actually sort of the point, like that's the end. And basically what I'm getting at is, if you told me tomorrow I get to choose between all of the congregations in the country mobilizing around important social justice issues and shrinking by 50%, but they're all doing that work and the people that are the 50% are doing it really well and really passionately. So massive hit to, like, quote unquote continuity or quote unquote membership, but huge boon to the activism itself versus don't do that and grow. I would choose the first one. Like, and so I guess I'm just like, as we talk about how this affects membership and how it affects, I want to hone in on the issues themselves that really, I think, are the things that we as Jews should be doing. And so I guess on those resolutions that you brought up that are coming, like what's the content of them, and what are the directions on some of these most important issues, especially in a moment that you've alluded to is particularly difficult for anybody that's trying to do positive oriented political work?
Yeah, Lex, what a great question. And thank you to the preamble, which I can only say amen, because if I try and say it differently, it won't be as good. I've seen that application, by the way, not only to the Jewish continuity industrial complex, where they kind of like, whatever the flavor of the month is, oh, young people care about racial justice. Quick, let's do racial justice. Young people see right through that, right? And I think one of the reasons why the RAC and the reform movement has become a magnet is we're doing it with authenticity, because it's the right thing, not as an instrumentality. You also see it in the pro-Israel space, where it's like, oh, we've got to get to the Black Lives Matter leadership because they called Israel genocide. Let's do racial justice. And then we can get to them. And again, Black Lives Matter activists see right through that. It is not going to happen that way. You got to show up in the space because it's the right thing, because you believe it's the right thing, or it's a failure. So with that, I think it's important to keep in perspective, there was kind of the world before the election and the world after the election. I want to say, even before the election, 1 in 3 Black men go to jail in America, while only 1 in 17 white men. And we had already, to honor our history with Kivi Kaplan and the NAACP and the nostalgia of the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, done a complete reboot of our commitment to racial justice, to say, if we were the Jewish community that brought you the RAC and the Voting Rights Act, we need to now quadruple down on that and really do a deep dive. We launched a campaign called Reflect, Relate, Reform, which was around a movement-wide discussion of racial justice within our own community, to read the new Jim Crow and really confront how mass incarceration has basically kept Jim Crow alive, how white privilege has benefited the Jewish community, and to do some real cheshbon nefesh, some self-assessment of our soul about how we may have inadvertently been complicit with systemic racism, and to understand the Voting Rights Act, how in 2012 it got eviscerated by the Supreme Court in a case called Shelby, and the way in which now, between mass incarceration and voter suppression laws that have been passed all across the country, we now have a major population of people of color whose right to vote has been suppressed, and how that has become part of the institutional racism. The gap between the rich and the poor and the abiding inequalities, largely related to communities of color, but not exclusively to. And the ways in which our LGBTQ brothers and sisters have been fighting and fighting and fighting, right? All of that was happening before. We couldn't get comprehensive immigration reform. So for years, we've had 11 million of our neighbors, the people that their kids go to our schools, they often clean our own toilets or cut our lawns, we're living in jeopardy. All that happened before this election. Now, with the election, what we're seeing is, both from a policy perspective, an assault on our values, where this stuff is getting codified into law, right? The repeal of DACA, so that dreamers are actually going to be torn from their families and their communities and sent home, or sent, not, I shouldn't say home, taken away from their homes and sent to countries that they don't know. The fact that our children who are transgender, who were protected under the executive order under Obama, now this president is saying this is a state and local issue. So one of the things we're doing is going to school boards across the country. We said, okay, if it's state and local, wherever there's a Reform Jewish institution, we want that institution to hold the local school board accountable to protecting the rights of transgender folk. And then, of course, there's the rise of bigotry and hate. After Charlottesville, it's impossible not to talk about Jews will not replace us. When you have tiki torch carrying, assault rifle bearing Nazis who are literally marching outside a synagogue, threatening the community who are praying, you know, inside and have to sneak out the back door. And we know just down the block, there's a mosque that's afraid of getting firebombed. You know, no Jews, no dogs. They don't even bother with us. More relevant now than ever. So our communities have to come together in solidarity and to beat back hate and bigotry. But I don't want to stop there, right? It can't just be about like we come together against hate. We also have to build the political power to make sure that hate doesn't get translated into policies that can pass city councils or state legislatures, or as we may see in Congress and because of this administration.
One little hint or thread that I think has come up here or there, but that we haven't quite fleshed out yet, relates to, across lines of difference, I think is the phrase you've used, in interfaith kinds of work. And I'd love to think about that more, because as you described, I mean, the literal origin story of the Religious Action Center is one of working across religious lines. Reverend, people forget, you know, Martin Luther King, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, was, of course, a minister. And so I guess I'd love to hear, once again, I hone in on names a lot. Religious Action Center isn't Jewish Action Center. It could very easily be embraced, at least on a name basis, by one who is not Jewish. If hypothetical situation arises where, you know, in one of these local communities you're talking about, there's a synagogue that wants to do local organizing to ensure the rights of people in their community in a time where those rights are threatened. And, you know, the congregation isn't on board universally, but there's a faction of the congregation, you know, some of them in interfaith relationships, some of them just have their friends. And that faction decides they're going to do this work, and they're going to do it with whoever in the community wants to. And it's still going to be Jewish work. It's still going to be infused by Jewish values, but not all the people involved are going to be Jewish. I'm guessing based on some of the things you said that would be a very good thing. It wouldn't be good that the congregation didn't want to participate, but it would be good that people are still rallying to that cause. And so I guess I'd love to hear what does the organizing across religious lines look like, and can such organizing, when not all the people involved are Jewish, still be Jewish organizing, if that makes sense, or Jewish activism or Jewish action?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Lex, and it's messy. You know, in the ideal, the world as it should be, when a congregation is acting collectively, you have like a na'aseh v'nishma moment. And to translate, that's like the all this we will do and we will hear. It's the moment when all of Israel in one voice stood at Sinai and accepted the covenant. And you want to say, really? Like there wasn't somebody who raised their hand? You know, I disagree, or I mean, this is the Jews, right? So it's, you know, it would never happen that an entire congregational body and all of the neighbors and friends connected to that congregation would be of one voice. On the other hand, the reason we do all those one-on-one conversations and all those house meetings is really to try and build as much consensus and come together. And by the way, that's not only to say, yes, we reflect most of the people, but also you can get the people to show up. I mean, that's really what has marked the difference in my leadership. I'm trying to not just go into a member of Congress and say, I represent, because I know the congressperson will say, well, where are they? But to actually be able to say, I got 1,000 people in Ohio, in Columbus, in your face, in your office, persistently and consistently. So we do all that engagement, both to reflect the people, but also to get the people engaged and get them to show up and have more political power. So that said, I think, again, in the world as it should be, they're doing it as Jews in a collective vision of what it means to be Jews of Temple, you know, Rodef Tzedek, the pursuit of justice. And then they're doing it together with like Resurrection Lutheran, the Lutheran church next door that is doing it deeply rooted in the gospel of Jesus. even though we know there are members of our temple who are married to members of that church and who celebrate, you know, so it is kind of a wonderful, messy, and interesting mix. It's what Reverend William Barber calls fusion politics. You know, we bring our complex identities and narratives to the table, and they're part of our stories. And, you know, so you have like, you know, people who are Jews of color, who are the product of interfaith families, who are bringing all of that. And so it's part of the, you know, delicious kind of stew of Jewish life that makes it just tastier and more interesting. And I think, you know, so I think it's part of it. And I think it's making boundaries and lines harder to see. And I don't focus on the boundaries and what keeps us different. I focus on what will bring us together and how to affect positive change. By the way, because I mentioned Reverend Barber, I got to share a story that he told recently, which is really incredible. We did a big push over the summer. We gathered hundreds of Reformed Jewish leaders from all over the country in Durham, North Carolina, for a big election protection push, because North Carolina was the site of one of the worst voter suppression laws. And Reverend William Barber, there as the president of the NAACP in North Carolina, he kind of invited us in to do a partnership between the NAACP and the Jewish community. And I gave the sermon that night, and I told the story about the Voting Rights Act and the RAC and how we're so proud. He stood up after I was finished and he said, "Rabbi, let me issue a correction, a Talmudic emendation, if you will. The Voting Rights Act was not written in a conference room in Washington. It was written in blood in Selma, and it was transcribed in your conference room." And it kind of, you know, Lex, it reminded me of what's at stake here. You know, this, the civil rights movement happened on a grassroots level in Selma and in Mississippi Summer and in Birmingham, you know, and in congregations and so across the country. And so that's what this moment calls for too. You know, is how are we going to come together, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Black, Latino, Brown, you know, around common values and common purpose, about what brings us together.
Can we get into a little bit more of the Jewish meat of all this? You know, can you share with us some, you know, for our listeners who may not always be thinking about Jewish texts, like what are the deepest Jewish sources for the work that you're doing? You know, how do you think about that in terms of who we are as Jews beyond our history?
You know, I'll answer that first with a caveat that if you take a step back and consider Jewish text in its total, it's all a critique of the world as it is and lays out the world as it should be, right? Inherently, that's what it is. It's the story from a creation which God tried to get it right and it was broken from the very beginning, and a journey, a narrative, you know, right through the Exodus from Egypt into the prophets, and then the hope of a promised land where we could live as a people in peace and justice. The whole thing is a critique of all that which is broken and all the kind of problems that people create that have to be solved with solutions of justice, right? So I don't want to pick a proof text and say, well, this is the one, right? I think it's the tradition and totem. That said, if you pushed me on it, I kind of think the fact that the one thing that most Jews do every year, no matter how secular they are, and no matter how little they go to shul, to synagogue, they go to a Seder. They might go to the, like, you know, Black Jewish lesbian Seder, because this is our thing. We recreate the narrative, which is you were slaves in Egypt, and so you know what it is to be oppressed. Therefore, you shall not oppress the widow, the orphan, or the stranger. If you, you know, push me and said, Jonah, what is the thing? You know, what gets me out of bed in the morning and helps me sleep at night as a Jew? It is you were strangers in Egypt. Therefore, you shall not oppress the widow, the orphan, or the stranger. You were slaves and you were free. We relive that narrative every time I go down to the hill. Like this afternoon, I got to go down there once again and get into another fight. When we go to the hill, when we get into a congregation, when I walk the streets of the South Bronx, when we get into a congregation in Ohio that's fighting for, you know, a kid who's severely disabled, who will lose their healthcare benefits. If Portman votes the wrong way on healthcare and the thing passes, he will lose his healthcare benefits. It is you are strangers in the land of Egypt. That is, I think, the animating principle to me. One other text, like as the Devar Acher or another alternative, it amazes me that every Yom Kippur, which is another place many Jews, no matter how little they go to shul, they wind up back on Yom Kippur. And we read the greatest text in Jewish tradition, Isaiah 58, where Isaiah and Franz Kafka wrote the most powerful thing about this text. in his day, Isaiah walks into the temple, the Holy of Holies, which was corrupt. It had been taken over by self-interested kind of priests who are hacks and were complicit with the ruling elite. And he walks in and interrupts the whole sacrificial service and says, this is not the fast that I want, speaking for God, right? But rather that you feed the hungry and you house the homeless. Interrupting thousands of people in the middle of their prayers. Kafka said, it was like a leopard walked into the sanctuary. You can imagine chaos, screaming, outrage. If it happened today in a young people's service at like Temple Emmanuel in New York, the police would be called in. He'd be escorted out and it would have been chaos. And Kafka says, and then the rabbis made it into liturgy. Nobody notices it anymore. And sometimes they don't even translate it. Every year I want to stand up on Yom Kippur in the middle of the service and say, are you listening? This is not about the liturgy. It's not about the prayers. It's about the streets right outside, which are as desperate today as they were in antiquity.
Yeah, let's talk about an aspect that I think connects to this, because it's certainly something that I was thinking very early on after Donald Trump became president and there were all these things happening to other minority groups. And you'd sort of hear some of the Jewish conversation about it, you know, it was a little tepid. And then when there was some, you know, anti-Semitic act, turned out it was some Israeli kid, you know, prankster doing it. But then all the Jews got all upset, you know, sort of out of that fear of anti-Semitism. And it got me thinking that, you know, along the lines of, and I was formulating it back then, is that, you know, we should have already had a kind of a NATO mutual defense compact with other minority groups in America that says, you know, an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. And we shouldn't have to wait for the anti-Semitism to invoke that treaty when other groups are being attacked.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I worry about the Jewish community, right? On the one hand, I'm so moved and inspired, but overwhelmingly, we maintain ourselves as feeling connected to and advocates for and in solidarity with low-income people, immigrants. You know, one of the things that brought the whole Jewish community together was the Muslim ban and refugees. You know, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionists in lockstep on refugees and the Muslim ban. And just saying, we are refugees. We are the children of refugees. Even though more and more, you know, my grandma Fanny was a refugee when she was 16 years old. My children have no memory of her. Their children won't, but we stay disproportionately connected to those communities. On the other hand, the richer we get, the more successful we get, the more powerful we get, the more the danger is that we'll follow other white immigrant communities in America and become self-interested and not care about. Here's the other thing I want to say, just as a shout out to the many thoughtful political conservatives in the Reform Jewish movement. Many, I dialogue regularly. I make it as a practice to hear from people whose politics don't necessarily line up with either the positions of the movement or my own personal politics, to learn, to stretch, to be challenged. Universally, what I hear is, Rabbi, I care just as much about the poor as you do. I care as much about people of color as you do. And I think that my policy prescriptions are more effective to actually get people out of poverty or to help communities of color find equality in America. And I lose sleep over that. They may be right, but at least want to honor that it doesn't come out of some kind of racist, bigoted place. It comes out of a deep yearning for justice, not from everybody, of course. By the way, Lex earlier asked about, you know, kind of the diversity of the Jewish community, not only within the Reform movement, but you've got like Orthodox Jews who skewed one way during this election and Reform Jews who skewed radically in the other way. At the elite level, the Orthodox leadership and the Reform have stayed very close in dialogue. And people may remember, it was just a few weeks ago, it seems like a year ago already, that together the Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Rabbinic bodies all collectively decided not to host a high holiday phone call with this president because of the bigotry of Charlottesville and his utter lack of moral leadership. There was no debate about whether or not we should have that call. The different movements took different public positions about it because of the way that we are. But that was an untold story, that we were all on the same page around that. So there are these baseline things that bring the Jewish community, at least at the elite leadership level, together around.
Yeah. I want to lift up Selma and I want to lift up Mississippi Summer because personally, I lived in Mississippi for 2 years, and I was, my life changed drastically after attending the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, the event that was in Jackson that was marking that. And it changed deeply for a few reasons. It's not like I came into it without any sort of political consciousness and left with one. It's not that drastic, but I saw and heard a few things. One of them, first off, for those who aren't familiar, there were disproportionately high numbers of Jews who participated in Freedom Summer. Now, what we do with that, we could clap our hands and be proud of it, or we could take that as an obligation to follow their example. There's all sorts of different reactions. What was important for me to hear was the stories of these Jewish activists who came down, and simultaneously, one of them spoke about how he was only able to go because he was given financial assistance by his Jewish community at home. So that I heard that in one breath. And then I heard the same guy talk about how when he went to services somewhere in the South when he was working for a year or two on racial justice, on civil rights in the 60s, that a man, I kid you not, named Stonewall Cohen told him that he was not welcome to set foot in the congregation, and the rest of that congregation agreed with Stonewall, not with with Larry, the man who was telling this story. And it was important for me to see that because it shattered something for me that needed to be shattered, which was this myth that we Jews have always been on the right side. We've always been working for justice. I everything you just lifted up about how our tradition teaches from, you know, straightforwardly in Exodus through Isaiah, et cetera, that we need to be, I agree, I deeply, religiously agree with all of that. But we have many folks who haven't been on that page, including in our own lifetimes. My lifetime is a little shorter, but certainly in our historic memories, we can point to tons of rabbis, we can point to tons of organizational leaders that were not aligned with civil rights. We can find people that vigorously advocated for slavery during the Civil War, for example. And I guess just as we arc towards the close, I'd love to sort of throw that complication into the mix.
Totally.
And ask, like what, how can we do all this work that I really, that it sounds like we all agree really is an obligation. It's a Jewish necessity. How can we hold all that and also recognize that sometimes our communities are going to get it wrong and we have to tell them that too, just like we have to tell Donald Trump, who's not part of our community, that he's wrong.
I love the question, Lex, and I love the analogy. I'll close it out with a story that kind of gets at the question. So, and it's for your listeners, this is like a real-time example as opposed to, you know, what choices we made in the 60s. So there's a fight right now, which I think is resolved, but over the last few months between the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Quicken Loans Arena and an organization called the Greater Cleveland Congregations, which is dozens of churches and several synagogues and a mosque that work together to fight for economic justice and equality for all people in Greater Cleveland. It was Greater Cleveland Congregations that won Medicaid expansion. They worked with Governor Kasich. That was their signature victory. But it was also Greater Cleveland Congregations when the Tamir Rice case happened and the streets of Cleveland were in jeopardy of riots, as we had seen in other places like Ferguson and Baltimore. Greater Cleveland Congregation clergy, Jews, Christians, Black, White, Latino, marched the streets together and they kept the peace and then put pressure on the mayor to accept the Department of Justice's consent decree. So this is a good organization, a smart organization that has had multiple victories and really made Cleveland a better community over the last decade in its existence. Well, from members of their churches, they heard a real frustration that the city was giving way too big a subsidy for the Quicken Loans Arena that hosts the Cavs. And they were saying things like, we cannot even afford Cavs tickets, and yet they're giving millions of dollars to the Quicken Loans Arena. What about our broken schools? What about our neighborhoods? They got into a court fight and wound up getting a ballot initiative, which would have basically overruled the city and the county's decision. When this happened, many people in leadership at the Quicken Loans Arena and the real estate company that was doing this deal and the county executive were Jews and came out really hard against Greater Cleveland congregations, so much so that two synagogues that were part of GCC quit. I know the story because I flew out to Cleveland about 3 weeks ago to go speak at Fairmount Temple, the temple that was the temple led by Rabbi Arthur Lelieveld, who marched in Mississippi summer and did voter registration and had his head bashed in with a tire iron. So I went to speak in that pulpit and to reassure the members of the congregation. And there were hundreds of people. I, you know, if I speak on a Friday night, I get 100, 200 people. That's nice. It was standing room only because the congregation wanted to hear about this controversy. But the point was what I said to the congregation, what I'll say to you is, this is not without risk and not without controversy and disagreement. But where I really admire the congregation was they were willing, when they heard the call from their allies, when they felt the sacred call of Isaiah echoing across eternity, they weren't afraid to take a risk. And what I heard from every member of the congregation who I spoke to, even those who were opposed to what the rabbis had done and what the congregation was doing, they said, I support my rabbis no matter what. And so I think, Lex, we have to come to a place where we know that we're not always right. We can agree to disagree, but at the end of the day, we have to hear Isaiah challenging us. To do nothing means that we're complicit.
I think you said amen earlier to something that Lex said, so I'm going to say amen to that. And thank you so much for being with us today. It's really great to hear everything that you're doing.
My pleasure. This is an awesome podcast. Thank you both so much.
Thanks again to Jonah Pesner for joining us. It's been a great conversation. We want to close out this episode by encouraging all of you to be in touch with us, and there's a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can check out our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can always hit us up via email at either dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org, or both. You can always send a note to both of us. And the last plug we like to make is that you can always support us financially with either a one-time donation or a monthly recurring gift, and you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. We want to encourage you to check out the other episodes in this Reform Judaism series. There's been a few that came out before this one with Jonah Pesner, and there's a few more coming up. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.